everybody. Welcome to Therapy Rocks, a personal growth podcast. I'm your host, Signe Darpinian, co-author of No Way, A Teen's Guide to Positive Body Image, Food, and Emotional Wisdom, published with Jessica Kingsley Publishers in London, who just won the British Book Award for Best Academic, Educational, and Professional Publisher of the Year. Today, we are going to talk to Dr. Joanna Steinglass about the neurocircuitry of habit, and more specifically, the habit-based model with food. Dr. Steinglass is a professor of psychiatry and associate director of the Center for Eating Disorders at Columbia University Medical Center and the New York State Psychiatric Institute. Dr. Steinglass graduated from Amherst College, where she studied psychobiology and received her medical degree from Harvard Medical School. She completed her psychiatry training and research fellowship in eating disorders at Columbia and has been on faculty ever since. Her research aims to understand the mechanisms of anorexia nervosa and to develop mechanism-based treatments. Dr. Steinglass, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. It's nice to be here.
Dr. Steinglass, I first heard you speak a few years ago at the Academy of Eating Disorder Conference on the habit-based model with food. And then a couple months after that, I was reading Scientific American magazine on the same topic. And of course, you co-authored that article as well. And I've got to tell you, the learning about the habit-based model with food has made one of the biggest impacts on the way that I treat my eating disorder clients. And I was thinking that it might be a good idea to start off by defining habit for our listeners.
That's a good place to start. Habit can be a kind of a tricky word. It has a rich background, scientific background, both in the neurosciences world and in the social science, behavioral science world. And there are similarities in the two ways of defining habit. And then there are also some differences that have to do with the questions that those different fields ask. But what are the key features in both ways of thinking about a habit is that they are behaviors that are learned. So they're not innate things like reflexes or something you're born with. It's something you learn, and they develop over time. And that the behavior is something that's more closely connected to the cue, the thing that sets off the behavior, and is less closely connected to the outcome or what happens after the behavior or the thing you might be trying to achieve with the behavior. In neuroscience, there's a key feature that as you learn these behaviors, so there's a setting or a something that sets off a routine of behaviors, and you learn to do the same thing in the same setting over and over again. And over time, as it gets kind of stamped in the brain, it shifts to a different part of the brain. And that in the neuroscience world, it is defined in part by having shifted to a different part of the brain. Whereas in the social science world, it's defined by this idea of being somewhat independent of the outcome. So an example from animal literature would be that if you have a rat and you put it in a cage and you train it to press a lever to get a reward, it doesn't do that automatically. It sort of pokes around in the cage, and eventually it starts to learn that if I press this lever, I get a reward. Does it over and over and over again, it keeps getting the reward. And then maybe you stop putting the reward, you stop putting it in. So it keeps, when it presses the lever, it gets nothing. But by now, it's so used to just seeing that lever and pressing it that it's going to keep doing it anyway. And at that point, it's considered to be a habit because it's not dependent on getting the reward anymore. It's a behavior the rat is just going to do. And what we've learned is that as that happens, it's shifted to a different part of the brain. And that part of the brain is a little bit less accessible. It's sort of more deeply entrenched and kind of harder to change once it gets there. So the neuroscience definition is really important. And one of the kind of the reasons to think like that, or the reasons to really highlight this definition of the word, is because it can sound a little funny to people, right? Habits is a word we use all the time. But when we're using it in this science context, we really do have a pretty specific definition.
And Dr. Steinglass, I remember your team speaking about it in a metaphorical way where, you know, the more you engage in a behavior, it's sort of like a hula hoop. Well, assuming you're not very good at the hula hoop, right?
Okay.
Where it kind of goes down lower and lower and kind of deeper into a deeper structure. Is that right? The dorsal striatum?
Yes, exactly. So the idea is that when you're first learning to do something, there's a whole series of reward-based circuits in the brain that happen to be these ventral circuits, meaning they're kind of closer to the bottom side of the brain. And that's what we think of when we talk about reward processing or things people have learned about dopamine and reward, that you do something that's rewarding and that's what leads you to do it again. And then what you're describing is that as you do it over and over again, the circuit goes round and round and it actually shifts to this dorsal part of the brain, which is a little bit higher up, a little closer to the top of the head.
I see. Is it true that we have evolved to have habit so that we can expend energy doing other things? For example, if we didn't have habit, would we have to wake up and relearn how to tie our shoes and brush our teeth every morning?
That would be awkward. So, I mean, I can't speak to the purpose of evolution, but certainly you're right that there's an efficiency to habits. That is the idea that as something becomes more habitual, it is thought to be more efficient in its use of cognitive power, so that there are certainly advantages to things like, so brushing your teeth is a perfect example, because when you're first learning, you really have to focus and concentrate and learn exactly what to do. And then as you practice that and grow up and become an adult, you might find yourself thinking about other things while you're brushing your teeth. And you might realize that you've actually just gained, you know, 3.5 whole minutes in your day to think about whatever you want while you're busy, just while your habit circuits are helping you brush your teeth.
One of the things that I didn't really expect when learning about the habit-based model with food, and of course I still have a lot to learn, but what I didn't think about ahead of time is how when people understand the neurocircuitry of habit, it reduces shame for them around not being able to change a behavior so easily on their own.
I appreciate that you've had that experience. We have also really had that in talking with patients. When we first started talking about this model or thinking about how this might be related to eating disorders and kind of habits that people would like to change, we really first went straight to the patients that we take care of and asked them, what do you guys think about this idea? Does it seem relevant? And we were pretty cautious about using the word habit because we worried that it might sound like it was trivializing what is actually a very serious problem. And we explained the model to people and we tried to explain what we meant from the science perspective. And what our experience was exactly what you're describing, that when we clarified what we mean by habit, people found it greatly relieving to realize that maybe these were things that maybe they had done at some point, they had done some of these behaviors on purpose or parts of them on purpose, but that what their brain was doing was trying to efficiently move the practiced behaviors out of their way so that they could do other things. And that helped understand why some things maybe had become automatic for them and helped them to think about it being a neural wiring that they wanted to work in treatment to get more of an understanding of it and develop some new ideas for how to make change.
I'm thinking the reward initially might be the weight loss, and then the secondary gain that individuals might receive from, you know, from their family or friends about, oh, you look great, you've lost weight. Can you take that a little further and maybe define anorexia nervosa too?
Yeah. When I talk about what happens with anorexia and how it develops, I really do like to start by pointing out that it may or may not have been the weight loss in the beginning. So that one of the things that is important about this way of looking at it is that one of the central problems in anorexia nervosa is that there's inadequate energy intake, right? So people just are not consuming enough to maintain their nutritional needs. And that may have started as something for any number of reasons. So it may have been that they started out with an intent to change shape or weight, but it may not have been. It may have been that, you know, one of the most common beginnings is something like somebody joins a track team or goes away to camp, and just something shifts in the energy balance that may not have anything to do with intent to lose weight or even necessarily with intent to change eating behavior. But something happens and then it gets repeated. So you don't develop this illness overnight. It really has to do with repeating these behaviors. And as they get repeated, like you say, there may be some kind of rewards that the person receives. But actually, it could be totally idiosyncratic. Those rewards could be very specific to that person. So for one person, it may be that they receive some positive feedback from others. Or for another person, it could be that it just feels like they've done something that they feel proud of, or they've made a change that they feel good about. Or for somebody else, it may be that for some reason, they just feel stronger, or, you know, it could be anything, any personalized reward. But whatever that is, that's what keeps the behavior getting repeated. And then as it gets repeated, unfortunately, that leads to the excessive amount of weight loss that really seems to be part of the spiral of anorexia nervosa.
My co-authors and I are really grateful to you and your team at Columbia. You actually contributed to our teen workbook, No Way. In Chapter 11 specifically, together we came up with a case example. We have this scenario where, let's say that this young boy, we'll call him Johnny, comes home from school every day, and let's pretend that he is not hungry. So he's had a significant snack. There's definitely not any hunger in the mix. And every single day that he comes home from school, he has this heaping bowl of vanilla ice cream. So it's like the same flavor, same time each day without hunger. And by the way, just a little side note, I'm not at all demonizing non-hunger eating, nor am I demonizing ice cream. Those two things are perfectly, quote unquote, normal parts of a peaceful relationship to food. But it's when it becomes more chronic, or in this case, habitual, that it might be a problem. And so your team was saying that the highest goal initially is to replace that old habit with a new habit that's somewhat rewarding. So in this case, we wouldn't say like, hey, Johnny, when you get home from school, instead of having this heaping bowl of vanilla ice cream, we're going to have you do your homework instead. But what you might do is like, hey, Johnny, when you get home from school, how about an apple and 30 minutes of television? I'm wondering, can you give us an example in this scenario how one might get started in reversing a habit such as Johnny's?
Sure. Again, we worked pretty closely with the patients in our clinic to develop strategies for how to take what is a kind of repeated, somewhat automated, not robotic, but somewhat automated repetitive behavior, and figure out how you could do things differently and want to keep doing it differently, so that you could develop new sets of routines that might serve. The way we talk about it is that these behaviors serve the eating disorder. And we want to find things that don't serve the eating disorder, but serve the person much better. The first thing that we usually do is think through what exactly these routines are. So the key to all of this is taking things that are somewhat automated and developing more awareness so that you can come up with new ideas. So for the example you gave, there's probably a parent in the story who is watching the routines and can help look at what all the behaviors are. In our case, we were really asking patients to sit with us and think through, if this is the behavior that you're thinking of, what did you do right before that? And what did you do right before that? And what did you do right before that? And really trying to figure out, what is the whole chain of behaviors, the whole sequence of events? And the idea there is to figure out, first of all, what the cue would be. So if we can get back to the beginning of the cue for the behavior, we can look for when in the series of events it would be easiest to do something differently. So that one of the things that happens with this whole idea of habits is that the different pieces of the routine get kind of lumped together. It's actually called chunking in the neuroscience world, where kind of one thing leads to another. So if we can get to the beginning of the one thing that led to another, we can figure out an easy place to do something new. So you were mentioning that when Johnny gets home, he might find something else to do, which might be a really good place to start. Or Johnny might say to you, you know what, by the time I get home, I already feel really strongly about the next thing I want to do, which is the ice cream. So maybe what I actually need to do is do something different right when I get off the bus, or maybe even as I'm getting ready to get off the bus, so that I have something else I'm doing or planning to do that would bypass all the cues that set off the behavior that we're trying to change.
So the cue I had in mind, I think, is a little too late in the chain. So the cue I was thinking of is imagining Johnny walking in and the first thing he does is go to the fridge with or without hunger. And so what you're saying is if we wait till he's actually home and heading toward the fridge, the urge actually might be too high. So you might do something different or grab a cue that is earlier than getting home and having access to the fridge.
And I might, most importantly, ask Johnny to help me figure out, you know, when in the chain does he think it would be easiest to do something different? So that it might be that you found exactly the right cue, or it might be that he tries to do that and it's too hard, and so we would back it up. But the idea of this approach is that you're looking for the moment in the sequence of events that it's actually the easiest to take a different path. We talk about alternate routes or alternate paths or something. If we can find something early on where your emotions are low and the intensity of the feelings around the behavior are actually at their lowest, so that it would be easy to try something new, and then you get to practice the new behavior. And if it's too hard, then it's hard to keep doing it over and over again. You might white knuckle your way through it once, but it has some difficulties being repeated if it's really hard to do.
I see. Okay. And it makes me think of a client that I'm working with right now, and I have permission to share this, where she is in late stages of recovery from binge eating disorder. And by the way, when I share this link, I'll attach definitions of the various eating disorders for those who might not know them. But anyway, she is in late stages of recovery for her eating disorder, binge eating disorder. And she's identified that on a Saturday, for example, if she wakes up and takes a shower versus waking up, not taking a shower, staying in jammies, that will actually be the difference between having a day with binge eating versus not having a day of binging. Just that simple cue, well, simple or maybe not so simple, cue of taking the shower versus staying in pajamas.
Yeah. And I would hypothesize, so part of our theory with this approach is that what you've done there is partly changed the cue and also added in some element of reward that's connected to the new behavior. So there may be for her something about getting dressed that and getting showered that actually feels accomplished or feels, you know, gives you just a little bit of something that feels good. It doesn't have to, it's not likely to feel as good as ice cream. If we go back to the other one, ice cream is wonderful. So it's hard to find things that feel as good as that. But if you've got something that feels good about it and you can work with the therapy to focus on that good feeling, which is another nice element actually of this treatment, that you really spend a lot of time thinking about and talking about the things that feel good about the new behavior and feel a little bit rewarding. And if you give that a lot of nourishment, then maybe those behaviors that serve health can be repeated and amplified and can kind of nudge out some of those behaviors that are serving the eating disorder.
Okay. And I'm glad you said that because it is hard to compete with vanilla ice cream. and it seems like you're saying that there's a little bit maybe in the beginning of resetting your set point in a way. So if you're initially replacing the vanilla ice cream with a shower or with watching television, that it might not be as great as the vanilla ice cream, but that over time, it may feel just fine.
I was thinking that that also underscores how much of a collaboration this work is. So that you find places in the kinds of things that a person wants to see change in. And if you can identify the kinds of behaviors that you feel interested in changing, then it's easier to feel something about that, even if it's a very small reward. It's such a relief for people sometimes to have it feel that they're doing something that has anything positive to it, as opposed to something that feels just exhausting.
Okay. Yeah. And it makes me think of, you know, the example of the woman waking up, taking the shower, getting dressed, and not engaging in the food behavior. The reward also can be like the, what I call foodless fulfillment. So it gives her an opportunity to kind of figure out what it is that she might be hungry for that's not food, assuming she's not hungry, like something fun to do, for example, or something that provides a bit more of a feeling of content.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that has come up a lot for us in this work has even been the feeling of kind of unyoked, like as though instead of feeling at the mercy of the eating disorder, they did something a little bit different. And it was actually a powerful feeling, even if it was a small feeling or even if it was a small change. But the idea that they could kind of release themselves from the power of the eating disorder a little bit felt like such an accomplishment and just felt like freedom.
You know, I was wondering, is the goal of the habit reversal work to have no habit at all? Or to not to need to have a habit at all?
Well, that's a challenging question. I have not tried to frame it that way exactly, because of course, having habits might be very helpful. And especially if we can help people to develop the habits that serve their goals, that would be great. The goal really is to shift from the kinds of habits that are no longer meeting your own values and your own needs and are just serving this illness, and to find new behaviors that, now if you get really good at the new behaviors, and they may become habits as well, which would be great, because then again, you have that efficiency of cognitive thinking, and you can do other things and not have to focus quite so hard on making sure that you're nourishing yourself properly. That may take time.
And so what about a habit if you were working on not necessarily habit reversal, but increasing habits, more like habit formation?
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Can you give an example of how somebody may increase the habit of exercise as an example?
Sure. So the key elements, and this really comes from a lot of social science research and exercise in particular, actually, they know a lot about how to increase physical activity. So some of the key features are creating cues, so that if you always start your routine in the same space or the same lazy, you put your shoes next to your bed so that when you get up in the morning, they cue you right there. So you can set up cues for the new behavior. Anything that maintains the routine in the same time of day seems to be another cue that would help reinforce the learning of a new routine. So anything that increases your cue awareness, setting up your environment so that you will encounter the cue that you want and not the cue that you don't want, and thinking about things going into those moments that increase your thinking about your own values. So there are ways, it doesn't fit so well with the waking up first thing in the morning, but if you pick a different time of day, then if there's something that you do as an exercise to remind yourself, I mean, I don't mean a physical exercise, a mental exercise to remind yourself of what your values are, that may actually increase your interest and ability to follow the new routine.
And I'm assuming it may also be rewarding to engage or to try to explore different types of movement that are joyful to you.
Absolutely.
That feel good, you know, that you like.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay. And we'll stick with the theme of eating disorders, but I'm hoping this can be applicable to other areas as well. But in my caseload, treating eating disorders, there, you know, is obviously a lot of body image dissatisfaction. And I'll oftentimes hear individuals who are in late stage recovery. So let's say that they are physically recovered, whatever that means for that particular individual. But they'll say things like, you know, I might be physically recovered, but I'll always have these bad body image thoughts. Can you speak, Dr. Steinglass, to this idea of habit of thought? Is that actually a thing? Is that true that somebody will always have a particular habit of thought?
So I think thoughts are less understood. They're less measurable. So it's much harder for the behavioral sciences to clarify what exactly those thoughts might be. The way I actually think about that in the habit framework would be that the thought might be more like the cue. The thought or the feeling might be an internal cue. Maybe it's not something in the environment that sets off whatever your routines are. Maybe it's something in your own either feelings or thoughts. So whatever it is that has you thinking about your body. And the habit approach would really focus on what happens next when you have that thought. What do you find yourself doing in response to that thought? And does that behavior serve you well, serve you poorly? So if you're somebody who is, as you were describing, feeling pretty well recovered behaviorally, but is still experiencing some of these distressing thoughts, maybe you're doing something great. Maybe when you have that cue, you've actually figured out how to do other things. And maybe it's time for a different tool other than the habit model. And there's a whole other set of, you know, therapy tools out there for how to be more compassionate with yourself about the thoughts or how to develop ways of accepting thoughts. The habit model becomes more useful for somebody who is responding to that thought with a set of behaviors that actually is making them feel worse instead of better.
Okay, so if there's the body image dissatisfaction and that individual is engaging in a type of quote-unquote body checking.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Lots of ways to define that. Weighing yourself on a scale, comparing yourself to another person, checking out your reflection in the mirror.
Exactly.
So that the body checking is more the habit that precipitates.
Mm-hmm.
The thought precipitates the habit. Okay.
Right. And those can be tricky.
Okay. Yes. Yes, they can, especially when it's culturally sanctioned to have those thoughts as well. What are your three top habit busting techniques, Dr. Steinglass?
So my therapy work in this area has really focused on anorexia nervosa. And we have developed an intervention that specifically helps people deal with their restrictive eating habits. So everything I'm going to tell you really comes from that orientation, and I hope it is applicable and that others will tell me how it works out in other settings. But everything I know about this, every trick I have really comes from the patients that we worked with. So that we work with somebody to figure out what kinds of what their chain of events is. And then I really rarely make suggestions. I really much more, when we look at the chain of events together, have had patients figure out what the creative ideas would be. And most people can figure out where in the chain would be the easiest and what kinds of things they should try. Now, I should say, you don't always get it right the first time. So you might pick a really good idea for an alternative behavior only to find that it was not a good idea at all. But through trial and error, we have focused on the development of cue awareness, which I was alluding to, as one way to help figure out what your behaviors are. And one sort of trick that ends up coming up a lot as a way to develop an awareness of what you do while you're eating is actually to start eating with your left hand, which seems awkward and silly. But what happens when you do that is you actually have to think much harder. So all the automatic parts go away, so that everything that we were talking about how brushing your teeth, you don't have to think about it. You can do it very efficiently. If you switch hands while you're eating, you have to think about every step of the way. And that really can lead to both more learning about what things you're doing that limit your intake, and also increasing your ability to override those habits.
I think I also remember hearing you talk about this at the Academy of Eating Disorder conference. And I think somehow it came up that an individual was thinking about, you know, thinking how they'd like to be different as it related to eating too fast. And I remember eating with a non-dominant mm-hmm. hand being suggested as a solution. I think it is so cool.
Yes. Again, it has to be in the right setting.
Right.
But when it works, it can be really helpful.
Right. So you might not want to do it like on a first date.
Another one is the development of competing responses. So this is really the classic idea of habit reversal therapy developed from the manuals for something called trichotillomania, which is hair pulling, unwanted hair pulling, mm-hmm. Which is and other kinds of automatic tics, where what you learn to do is when you feel the urge to do the behavior, you develop some other competing response that is incompatible with the automatic behavior. So for hair pulling, one example is squeezing something in your hand. If you're squeezing something in your hand, you can't be pulling your hair. And for our patients, it was sometimes something like, I mean, you need to know your own routines and figure out what it might be for you, but something like positioning yourself so that it was not possible to engage in the compensatory response to eating. So that if you're somebody who tries to get rid of food after you've eaten it, if you position yourself so that you simply can't get out of the dining situation very easily, then it just makes it not possible to do the automatic behavior, and that can be helpful.
I see. So a competing response is defined as anything that you put in place making your habit impossible to do. So, for example, if you're in the habit of texting while driving, hopefully you're not, but if you are, you know, it's like the thing that happens almost before you even know that it is.
Exactly.
Right?
That is a great example. Yeah.
So a competing response making your habit impossible to do initially might be putting your phone in the trunk for a while.
Now that one,
is that a competing response?
It could be. I mean, that one is actually also a change in the environmental cue because you actually don't even have it there.
Okay.
But if you put it just far enough out of reach, or if you make it so that you are holding something else, you know, if you keep your hand on the steering wheel then and move the phone just far enough away, then it would be the competing response. Either way, it would work. Whether that's a cue thing or a competing response, it's a good idea.
Okay.
So the other piece, the really key piece that we were talking about a lot before, is to how to develop that rewarding feeling. And that is just a key piece of finding a new behavior that gives you a little bit of joy so that you're willing to repeat it over and over again until it becomes the new routine. And for us, that was sometimes, for some people, it was introducing conversation into their meals. It may be very much a part of the eating disorder routine to, with all the anxiety that comes with eating, to be so focused on what's happening on the table that there isn't room to notice the people around the table. So that if you go in intentionally starting up a conversation at the beginning of the eating experience, some patients have described to us that made for something pleasant that happened even while the meal was still stressful and hard and was all those other things. It introduced something pleasant and rewarding that allowed them to pursue a different set of behaviors that contributed to better nourishment.
I love that. And I love the idea of setting your intent ahead of time. Have I left anything out? Any last thoughts you have?
I guess the other piece I would add, so I my experience with this has really been working with developing these routines with adult patients, but getting back to what your older adolescent and adult, but back to the example that you gave, every time I've talked about this, some parent of a patient with anorexia nervosa has come to tell me how much they would have liked to add this component when they were trying to help refeed their child. So that the idea that there would be something else you can do and not just a series of things you can't do is a nice tool to have. So this whole idea of habit reversal is really just another set of tools to help with the very difficult problem of eating disorders. But it's a useful tool because it gives you some creative options for things to do that serve your own needs or serve your child's needs.
And I couldn't agree more. That's exactly one of the impacts that it's had on my caseload. And I'll be sure to add a link as well for the type of therapy we're talking about, which is family-based therapy, otherwise known as FBT. Well, Dr. Steinglass, thank you so much for taking the time to come on the show today and telling us more about how we can free ourselves from the prison of habit and for your top three habit-busting techniques. How can our listeners find out more about your research clinic for the potential participation and treatment for the study?
Thank you for asking. We have an eating disorders research clinic where we're able to provide treatment at no cost for people who are interested in and eligible for the various research studies that we have going on. And one of the ones we have going on right now is trying to understand how these habits develop in teens with anorexia nervosa. So we're able to provide treatment for 2 years for people who are able to participate in a neuroimaging study. Which is really exciting because we're really hoping that this is going to help us learn how kids get stuck with this illness. We have a busy clinic and people can call us at 646-774-8066 to speak to somebody and get more information, or they can just Google the Columbia Center for Eating Disorders and that'll get you to our research page.
It sounds great. And thank you again for taking the time to come on the show, Dr. Steinglass.
My pleasure.
Thank you for joining us today for another episode of Therapy Rocks. And a reminder that you can rate and review me on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And feel free to contact me at www.signadarpinian.com. And we'll see you next month.